Hey, it's Andrew, the Director of Literary Arts. Here at Literary Arts, we rely on our community, people like you, for support. To help make this podcast and all our programming possible, give today, literary-arts.org/donate. Welcome to the Archive Project. I'm Andrew Proctor, Executive Director of Literary Arts. The Archive Project is a retrospective of some of the most engaging talks from the world's best writers for more than 35 years of literary arts in Portland. Support for the Archive Project is provided by Cole Haan. Cole Haan's shoes, bags, and outerwear go with you while you work your way to extraordinary. More at colehaan.com. In this episode, a conversation with Barry Lopez from March 2019. This event was particularly special since it was the national launch for Lopez's magisterial book, Horizon, which itself was 30 years in the making. It was a huge honor for Literary Arts to celebrate its publication, and important that Oregon, Lopez's home, was the place that launched one of his most important works. Horizon was first conceived of right after Lopez's National Book Award-winning Arctic Dreams was finished in 1986. He could see a larger, more complex and layered book that would deepen and extend many of the ideas and themes of Arctic Dreams. But at the time, Lopez did not feel he was ready to write such a book, so he carried the idea with him as he traveled the globe for the next 3 decades. Horizon is a book that defies category. It is not merely travel, science, or nature writing. It is not only a memoir or a book of natural history. It is all of these things. It is a book of beauty, violence, transcendence, trauma, and love. A spiritual book, a book of immense scale, from the migratory habits of whales to the atoms and particles of ice to the geological timescale of the Earth's mantle. It is a masterpiece and caps an unparalleled career in American literature, one that contributed to the reimagining and reinvention of nonfiction itself. I was honored to sit down with Barry Lopez to talk about Horizon in March 2019 in Portland. Lopez died on December 25th, 2020, at the age of 75, after a prolonged battle with cancer. He is remembered with fondness and reverence. This is a book that defies all categories, and if I had a quibble with the incredible rave reviews that it's already gotten, is that sometimes they call you a travel writer, or a nature writer, or a science writer, and none of those seem applicable, and they seem particularly inapplicable to this book, and that this book has an immense scale. So I wondered if you'd start by reading a section that begins in your childhood that seems to encapsulate all of these incredible aspects of this book. Would you read for us?
Yes. When I was young and wanted so much to see the world, my mother gave me an atlas, Hammond's Illustrated Library World Atlas, published in 1948. Overlaying some of the pages with tracing paper and using colored pencils, I lined out the journeys I wanted one day to make. Down the Yangtze from Chongqing to Shanghai, across the Great Victoria Desert in Australia, from Panama across the Darien Gap to Tierra del Fuego. Decades later, I took the old atlas down off a shelf. Its maps were now much dated. French West Africa and Belgian Congo, gone. Yugoslavia, dismantled. Ceylon had become Sri Lanka and Siam, Thailand. The Ellis Islands, Tuvalu. Several loose sheets of tracing paper fell free as I paged through the book. I'd completely forgotten about them. As I retrieved and stared at those tracings, I realized I'd managed to make many of these journeys in the intervening 40 years. In that moment, in front of the bookshelf, I suddenly felt the familiar sensations of wonder and gratitude, emotions I'd known for years now as a traveler. But this time, They rose up around the daydreams of an 8-year-old who wanted to go, but didn't know how. Maps held me in thrall when I was young. They combined in a single 2-dimensional space both the broad, all-encompassing reality that a great journey makes possible and the particularity of those places along the way that comprise the journey. To behold the map is to imagine in the same instant both the arc of the journey and the moments that will make it up. This, to make a bit of a leap, is part of the genius for me behind Monet's impressionistic representations at Giverny. The unfocused colors of these sketch-like images mimic the sketchiness of one's general recollection of movement through a particular geography, while at the same time, the painting consists of myriad discrete dabs of color. One of Monet's contemporaries, Camille Pissarro, painted panoramas of Parisian streets that work before the eye in the same way maps do. You appreciate the entirety of the area and simultaneously its discrete components. Travel, to my mind, can become a type of map making. As a young man, I read Darwin as much for the epic journey he describes in The Voyage of the Beagle as for his thoughts on how living organisms change through time while proceeding in no predetermined direction. I later read James Cook because I was attracted to and admired his disciplined effort to travel deliberately, and also for the way traveling had taught him about the world. I read the biographies and autobiography of Randall MacDonald because his quest for identity made him a different sort of traveler than explorers like Cook or Tasman or Matthew Flinders. MacDonald was born at the mouth of the Columbia in 1821. He had a Chinook mother and a Scots father. Traveling, despite the technological innovations that have brought cultural homogenization to much of the world, helps the curious and attentive itinerant understand how deep the notion goes that one place is never actually like another. Traveling encourages the revision of received wisdoms and the shedding of prejudices. It turns the mind toward a consideration of context and releases it from the dictatorship of absolute truths about humanity. It helps one understand that all people do not want to be on the same road. They prefer to be on their own road. Darwin taught that, like the panda or the thresher shark, Homo sapiens is an animal without a destination, and like all other animals, is known only in its present form, a transitional form, even if that form, like the coelacanths, is stable for long periods of time. Modern humans are part of a continuum that stretches from Homo heidelbergensis some 250,000 years ago to a descendant standing up ahead of us, invisible in the ether of the Anthropocene. No other creature, as far as I know, is as focused on identity and destiny as Homo sapiens. The desire to have special meaning in the world is one of the reasons I think humans search so diligently for the bones of their ancestors. The mere fact that they existed and are somehow related to us is reassuring to an animal that tends to view itself today as a barely tethered balloon reacting to the rising winds of accelerating cultural change. Many of us are not adapting smoothly to a rapidly changing world, especially psychologically. Our ancestors offer us historical meaning, but they give us no indication of the future. And what is true for us is true for every other animal. No matter our impressive history, every day we advance figuratively into evolutionary darkness. And because we are inescapably biological, we have no protection against extinction.
Thank you, Barry.
All right. Do you want this book back?
We just put it right here. You're sick of it already? That's beautiful.
I hope you bought that.
This book, in the acknowledgement section, you talk about this book emerging, or not this book, but a book emerging out of Arctic Dreams. And this book is a 30-year project for you, and assembled from field notes, and assembled from new writing, and assembled from...
Right.
Can you talk about the creation and the making of this book and the journey that you went on to make it?
I've had this incredibly privileged life. I want to do things, and then somehow I go and do them. And there was a warm response to Arctic Dreams, and my mind was racing ahead about how I could grow this feeling of curiosity about the world, respect for the reader, and see places I'd long to see. So my agent said, you know, now's the time to develop an outline for that book, and then we'll go around and talk to people about it. Scribner, who had been my publisher, was disintegrating, and I didn't like the new people. And I always want to work for people, not for corporations or company. I want a group of women and men who love language and story and the effect that they have on readers. So we ended up with a very well-known editor named Jonathan Galassi at Farrar Straus. That was one, and then the other was Knopf, where I had a really good relationship with the publisher, with Sonny Mehta. And I signed a contract, and because the people that put money on the table have to have this, they said, well, you've got to deliver this book by 1994, and I thought, yeah, all right. because I knew I was too immature to write the book that I proposed, and that I hadn't seen enough. So my editor, my publisher, everybody was concerned with that, said, go ahead. And I know that they got phone calls from Bertelsmann in Germany saying, where's that manuscript?
Yeah.
And nobody ever said a word to me. And I was free to develop the work. You know, I wrote 6 or 7 other books in that time, wrote a lot for magazines. And then I got to a point where I thought, I've got to do this now. So people say it was 30 years in the making. I'm 74 years in the making, and I could begin, I could start. So that was about 5 years ago, and I was making minor corrections, like the placement of a period at that level, until they took the manuscript away from me. And then it became a book. I kind of stare at it and wonder. But there's no, you can't overstate what it's like to work with people whom you admire and are professionally very good and want to make something with you, which is this physical book.
Yeah.
Carol Carson, who designed the book and that beautiful embossed cover and did the end sheets, these wonderful end sheets of the Nicholas Roerich painting. She wrote me a letter that came about a week ago and said, dear Barry, I loved working on this book and it's my swan song. I've been at Knopf for 31 years and there's no better way for me to go out.
Wow.
So you live to work with people like that. Nobody's taken up with themselves and how grand they are. They understand that the basis of this is to make something that takes care of people. So,
and I mean, if anyone were to describe your career, I feel like that's how they would describe it, and in all of its humility, and the way you have gone out. We were talking about this backstage and brought back things to us that many of us will never see. I want to talk about travel a little bit, because there's this line that popped out of me. It's a very short one at the beginning of the book that said, travel is something, I knew from an early age that travel would be something that would assuage me.
Yes.
And that word really popped out at me. It wasn't, you know, inspire me or dazzled me, but it assuaged you. And I wonder if you could talk about a lifetime of travel and the way it has assuaged you and what you meant by that line.
The first thing that pops into my mind is that travel took care of me. I say early in the book, because this is the first book I've written where I feel you really need to know who this person is and how I became, not a writer, but how I became enthralled with something. And so the front end of the book is autobiographical. As a child, I carried a lot of anxiety, the usual stuff, you know. Will the guys on the playground think I'm cool? Kind of stuff, yeah. You know. And I found it was a physical feeling of elevation to be out of the known territory. I wasn't afraid. I was cautious, you know, but I wasn't afraid. And, well, you know, I'll tell you a story that just popped into my head. The first book I published was a book called Desert Notes. And my mother was dying of cancer. And I wanted her to have that book before she passed. And I barely made it. I gave her a copy of the book in hospital, and she was lying in bed. She took it and she turned it like you would turn an object, turned it over, turned it end for end, and then put both her hands behind it and lay it against her chest. And she reached out with her left hand and put it on my forearm and said, "You'll be all right now." Hmm. And that awareness that she had, you know, she gave me that atlas when we were, you know, just my brother and me and my mother living in California. And that's all I needed, you know. I wanted her to know that the investment she made in my life, here I was, 20 whatever I was years old, and she intuited that I'd be all right. And it hurts me everything that happened to me as a writer was after that, and I could never give it to her. I could never put it in her hands again, never put another book in her hands. So assuage, I don't know, Andrew. There's something, I talk in the book about this time when I took the India Pacific train from Sydney to Perth, and being me, at the station in Sydney, I went up and saw the engineers and said, "Could I write up here?" And they said, "Well, yeah, sure, but don't do it obviously, you know. We're going to make a stop about 20 minutes out of town for water, and just step out on the platform like you're going to have a cigarette and look around and drift up to the front of the train and climb up." Mm. So that's how I rode. And, you know, this very sweet man who was the porter said, but you'll miss dinner." I said, "Oh, no, I'm making dinner here, all right." Yeah. So the thing that happened on that trip that speaks to the question you asked was, one day we had an incredible rainstorm. It was like driving underneath in the ocean. And then the rainbows came out and these kangaroos, 1,000 maybe kangaroos, were racing across the Nullarbor Plain. And I looked at it, and these two guys looked at it. One guy even left the train to run itself. We're all standing there at the window and going like this. Whatever it is, it's happening now, and we're here in it. And we all, nobody said anything. We just all shook hands. Like we caused it.
Congratulations.
Yeah. Right. Great. Good driving of the train. Get us this place.
That's right. But time and again, you are in these situations, you know, throughout your life. How do you find yourselves constantly? I mean, in Antarctica, maybe talk about how you and why you wanted to go there as part of this book and how it got included.
I'm like that 8-year-old kid with that atlas. You know, when she gave me that atlas, I took everything out of my closet and put it on a box at the foot of my bed, and I got a little school desk, and I moved it in there, and I put maps up on the wall, and a gooseneck lamp, and my atlas. And I sat in that room, it was my geography room, and I was so excited I didn't know what to do. And I think that that aspect of my adult character is still there and still insistent on, you need to go. You need to go and see. To write is a social instinct to make people more comfortable in the world with their own thoughts, their own ideas, their own sense of selfhood and capability. I think that there are parts of your young self that you outgrow naturally, but there are parts of your young self, like this hunger, that you needn't outgrow, and instead you should find out how to accommodate it.
And I think you've touched on something really interesting, though, that about, and you've written about this and talked about it, but I think it really comes through in this book, is the idea of what is our role in the world, and specifically for a writer, what is the writer's role in the world beyond going out and reporting on something that they've seen? There's a lot more to your life and your career and your work than simply that, and of course speaks to all of us about what our roles in the world are. And I wanna, can you talk a little bit about the way you position a writer in the world right now?
Well, like you, I went through the normal series of pockets of formal education, you know, and I finished a graduate degree, and then I began another huge part of my education, which was to go to people who were not like me, not white, middle-class, Christian men, and say, well, what do you think? And that's when the world really opened up for me. And then that's the world I became obsessed with, traveling with indigenous people, for example. And I would always ask when I was in a society other than my own, who is the storyteller for you? What does that mean? What do you, how does that figure in your day-to-day life? And I'd collect these impressions about what a writer was to be, none of which did I hear in university, but all of which made eminent sense to me. I remember a Métis man in Yellowknife. We were talking about storytelling, and I asked him, because he was multilingual, I said, I knew he spoke an Eastern Arctic dialect of the larger language called Inuktitut. And I said, what is the Inuktitut word for storyteller? And he said, that's Isumutok. And I said, well, what does it mean? And we talked about how the difficulty of translating, but here's what we arrived at. Itsumutok is the person who creates the atmosphere in which wisdom reveals itself. Mm-hmm. So it takes the load completely off you as the storyteller. That you're nobody, really. It's the story that's important. And it's not your wisdom, because wisdom is not necessary in order to write a beautiful story. What's necessary is a recognition of a pattern that captures something ineffable in the society of which you are a part, so everyone can recognize themselves in the story and see what their path looks like. So in exposing myself to ways other people thought about storytelling, I began to understand what my responsibility was. I mean, in the beginning, I can remember writing stories when I was 15 years old and thinking, wait till they get a hold of this. they didn't think much. I matured, I think, into an ancient occupation, which is one of the people in a social group whose job is to take a special kind of care about what happens to us. I mean, that sounds self-flattering, but it's not. You know, you have a job to do. And in talking to other writers, I find the area that doesn't get addressed very often is this notion of social responsibility. I mean, we're in a hellhole now as a culture. And so my question is, what is my part in providing clarity and elevation and calmness and insight and confidence to address everything that's after us like mad animals now?
I mean, the question of nature, which is what you're alluding to, I I think most in the natural world, and climate change plays an obviously a huge role in this book.
Yes.
And I wondered if you could talk about what I think is so startling about the way you talk about nature in the book, whether it's in the Antarctic or whether it's in the Galapagos or whether it's, I mean, this book travels the entire world. It's really remarkable and relates those places that are totally disparate in really interesting ways. But the idea of nature as indifferent, as amoral, as I think a lot of us relate to nature as people. And I think as a Portlander, I don't know, I think about Mount Hood as a place where I can go have a, you know, recreation. Mm-hmm. And I wonder if we, a lot of us treat the nature like an amusement park that is there for us to escape the city. But you decenter human activity in a way that's really interesting in the book and talk about nature, for example, evolutionary change, as having no destination. It's right. Just change, it's just adaptation.
Well, that was a scary thing, really, about Darwin. That there is no progression to a better thing. The idea that humanity can be perfected is not a good idea. There is only change in the organism in response to environment, and there's no ultimate goal. There's nothing there but change and change and more change through time. I think for me, you know, every one of us grows up as soft clay, and we're shaped by the thing. Camus has a line somewhere about the writer being someone who lives in a constant search for the two or three things in the presence of which his heart first opened, to go and seek that thing again and again and again. The metaphors of my early life were all about natural history. As some other person might find the metaphors of urban life the most informing and the most malleable in terms of creating a narrative. I got lucky, I guess is what I would say, but I grew up in a family with one brother and my mother. And father had business elsewhere, I think. But that meant that my younger brother and I were out in what the Australians say, out bush all the time. And those things became deeply comforting for me, that the landscape outside, the human and the human's constructs. But for somebody else, they would grow up in a different environment, and then later, if they found themselves writing, all this metaphorical material of childhood became the stuff you could really work with. So when I went, you know, my life changed dramatically when I was 11. I went away, my mother married again, we went to New York, to Manhattan, and all of a sudden I was in a coat and tie in a private Jesuit school, a little bit different from growing up in agricultural Southern California. And what I learned there about truth and beauty and 4 years of Latin and all of that stuff, I loved that too, but I didn't have my childhood wasn't shaped in that way. So when my time came to write about, a little presumptuous to say it this way, I guess, but when my time came to write about beauty, I went to the things that seemed unplumbable to me when I was a child. Really deep, really complicated, enthralling, and I could bring pretty much anything I wanted out of that raw material. So I think I'm probably an okay naturalist, but that's not what I'm about. I think I am about the safety of humanity, to help others who know more than I do in terms of making policy or something like that, forge a place where we're going to be okay. Because right now, to me, I don't think we're going to be okay. You know, and the book opens with the scene with my grandson sitting on a lanai next to a pool at a hotel in Waikiki. He and my wife, Deborah, just took him to see the USS Arizona. And I wanted him to know what this was, but I didn't want to terrify him by talking about, well, you know, the 8th Air Force in Dresden and bombing Nagasaki and those kinds of things. I just wanted him to understand the scale at which we are brutal and careless and vicious toward each other. And when we came back to the hotel, I was reading a book, I can't remember the author's name, it was a biography of John Steinbeck, and I'm sitting there reading the book, and this Japanese woman walked by me and then just flew off into the air and into the pool. And when she hit the water, this great skirt of crystals from the splash came up against the sun. And in that moment, I felt so tender toward everyone there, even though there's this ironic confrontation between the USS Arizona and mostly Japanese people in that hotel. Whatever residue of indignation I might have had, it just could never surface. And I don't feel that way anyway, but it was particularly sharp to sense an enormous desire in myself that everyone be okay. I want everyone to be all right. And you and I and our colleagues and everyone here plays a role in that, to comfort the afflicted, of which there are so many now for political reasons and environmental reasons and whatnot. I've answered the question, but I've forgotten what it was.
It's completely fine. That was a beautiful answer. Maybe to return to the title of the book, there's an incredible quote that I'm just going to read a short bit of, I think, that is really about the title, and I want to talk about the title Horizon, because right. In the book it takes a lot of different meanings.
Yeah.
About a third of the way through, you say, when a boundary in the known world becomes instead a beckoning horizon, the leading edge of a farther destination than a world has ever known becomes an integral part of one's own universe. Memory and imagination come into play. The unknown future calls out to the present and to the remembered past. And in that moment of expansion, the imagined future seems attainable. Can you talk about the trouble that we're in now in ways that you understand it, and what that horizon might mean, and how we might think about it being attainable?
Well, I knew the title of the book was, in fact, there it is in a contract in 1989. The book is called Horizon. And I didn't know what that was. There are things in the book, you know, in April of 1991, I was in Punta Arenas on the Strait of Magellan, and I rented a vehicle to take a drive to a place called Port Famine, which on the Brunswick Peninsula, which had become an interesting place to me. Darwin had visited there, you know, and other things were drawing me there. And the road I went there on was a gravel road, and I didn't see any people, saw a lot of birds, great beautiful high view of the Strait of Magellan. And then I encountered somebody, and I knew instantly that's the end of the book. This thing that's happening in front of me, this is the end of the book. And it was. I mean, it turned out to be that. So there's some strange ways in which I knew some of what was coming, but again, did not know how to get there. The idea that kept pushing at me was horizon. It beckons, and to me it always promised, you'll be all right. there was something that said, I know you're in a state of pain or confusion, but it'll be all right. So I didn't really know in the beginning what that was. You know, I had an outline, the outline I gave to Knopf in 1989 was these five places, this Skraeling Island and the Canadian High Arctic, Galapagos Islands, Northern Kenya, Australia, and Antarctica. I wanted to start at the very so-called top of the world and then come in this big sweeping movement around the equator and then close in the so-called bottom of the world. And there's all that business in the book about that is geographical arrangement. And I wanted to invert the globe so that when you finished in Antarctica, you really couldn't remember what's the top, what's the bottom? Because those are all hierarchical arrangements that are odious to so many social groups. I mean, so much, this is not to say disrespectfully anything about the women's movement or the environmental movement or the Native American movement, but all of them were efforts to point out the inutility and the trouble that comes with hierarchical arrangements. This person's better, this person's white, what, you know, on and on and on. Nothing but a minefield of death. So I just kept working at the book and trying to understand what I still needed to learn and how this was going to happen. I arrived at a point where I thought, I've got to anchor the ideas in this book in a real place. I can't be all over the map with it. So I selected this place where James Cook came ashore in North America, which is in Cape Foulweather here in Oregon. And that anchored my thinking about how the book was going to work. And then I realized I had to have a larger biographical, autobiographical component, because you really need to know who this narrator is, who's selecting this material instead of some other material. And then I felt I needed to write a short 4-page prologue in which the narrator is a vulnerable human being thinking about the responsibility he has to help in the education of my grandson, our grandson. But Horizon, I don't know. Till probably the fourth draft of the book had a subtitle, which was The Autobiography of a Journey, because what I'm doing is going to these places and then going to them again and then going to them again. But it seemed pretentious and it's just much cleaner to say Horizon. And I think it's not a good idea for me to say what it means. I mean, so much of what an individual person, an individual reader is going to get out of a book should be left up to them. And I know people will, I want a reader to say, here's what this meant to me. Here's how this became important to me. I really don't need to know it's an autobiography of somebody's journey. I want to talk about my journey.
I mean, I think it was such a great choice to skip the subtitle. I didn't know that story until right now, because I think it leaves open all of these doors in a way a subtitle can hem you in.
Yeah.
And I think what is masterful about the book and why it meant something to me was the way it moves between the personal, the natural, the subatomic at sometimes, and the universal. And it's those juxtapositions, when you read this book, I've never seen anything like it in literature before. It's incredibly exhilarating to read. And I picked out just a second reading, if you don't mind.
Oh, yeah. No.
It's that big number two there. In that post-it note, it takes place in Western Australia in a place called. It begins in a place called Tom Price, and I wonder if you could just tell us just a little bit about Tom Price before we begin.
I don't know very much about Tom Price, but it's a village. It's not a person.
Right.
And this is in Western Australia, one of the states in Australia. Western Australia at the time I was writing this was the only state in Australia that was financially in the black.
because its iron ore was 90% of it was going to China, and there was a huge financial gain selling the ground to the Chinese. So I had a friend in Perth, and she said, we're going to make this trip, we'd love you to come along, and we're going to ask another American writer and photographer and a painter, and we're just going to go up into an area of Western Australia called the Pilbara, and we'll just drive and look at things in particular, and then we'll end up at a place called Port Hedland, which is a bit smaller than Sydney, but it is the biggest for shipping. It's the biggest port in Australia, and most of what they ship is iron ore. The seven of us were up and gone from Tom Price before sunrise, driving unpaved roads that took us into the heart of the Karajini, a landscape that looked as if it were still damp from the creation. Paul had been all through this country before, photographing, and Larry had seen a good bit of it as well. We descended into and climbed out of deep desert canyons, narrow fissures and a rolling plain that rose to imposing heights in the Hammersley Range to the north and west of us, a brilliant magenta shield dotted with white-barked gum trees and clumps of golden-colored spinifex grass. The crystalline air was shot through with bird calls, and flocks of white little corellas and pink galahs passed so close over us we could hear the creak of ligaments in their wings. We swam in still pools of cool water and in slow-moving rivers in the bottoms of several of the gorges, out of the direct rays of the sun, but with the brightness of its incident light ricocheting off rocks of 2 billion-year-old rock, walls in every shade of purple one might catalog, from damson to heliotrope, from hyacinth to raisin, each purple changing hue as the hours passed and as the sun's reflected rays became direct, creating a harsher light. In one canyon we hiked into, we stopped for a while where a narrow river bar had formed and several river red gums and weeping paper barks had taken root. Jeweled geckos ran the vertical walls on either side of the canyon, great slabs of incinerated blacks and bronzed purples. As I lay back on cool sandy soil, a flock of about 20 zebra finches passed across the narrow strip of blue above the canyon, small, brightly colored passerines with large bills and barred tails, quick as a school of mackerel. They were gone before their wooing cries reached the floor of the canyon where we lay. Up on the plain, in great reaches of hummocky grassland to either side of the red-orange dirt tracks on, on which we drove, termite mounds rose higher than the tall of us stood. Red kangaroos and common wallaroos, suddenly alert as our trucks rolled to a stop, bounded away, drawing the eye to bare escarpment walls rising at the base of the Hammersley Range. The traditional owners here are Banyajima, Kinhawarga, and Kurama people. Their occupancy goes back more than 30,000 years. To an outlander, the countryside appears primordial, but it has been shaped by these people's hunting and gathering strategies and by the fires they've deliberately set pursuing their fire stick style of farming. Mags and Marilyn had wanted the five of us to see Karajini to establish a kind of baseline awareness of the country we would be traveling through, by comparison with which Karajini appears completely untouched. Leaving there, we swung north toward Dampier, situated at the far end of the Tom Price Railway Road, which parallels the tracks that convey the iron ore trains out of the Hammersley Range toward the deep water harbors at Dampier and Port Hedland. As we left the park, an open pit iron ore mine called Marandu
shares a boundary with Caragini on three sides of the on three of the mine's four sides. The signs of human infrastructure quickly emerged from the otherwise apparently untenanted land. Fence lines declaring exclusive ownership and the many modern conduits for water, electricity, fuel, and information. Power line pylons, cell phone towers, and pipelines. Inscribed amid these was a maze of improved and primitive roads, from sealed bitumen two-lane highways to roads too dangerous on our map, our maps warned, to attempt in a single vehicle. In such spots, a convoy is preferable, where mutual aid ensures some success, at least, in dealing with flash flood, washouts, drifting sand, and broken axles. The maps also warned us away from areas closed to the public, abandoned mining towns like Wittenoom, where asbestos fibers still swirling in the air are too easily inhaled. Loaded iron ore trains gain on us and roll past as we drive north, trains too long for us to be able to see both ends in the same moment, each end lying as it does over the curve of the earth. The longest train ever documented passed this way in 1993. It consisted of 682 iron ore cars pushed from behind and pulled ahead by eight diesel-electric car engine locomotives. It was nearly 4.5 miles long and was carrying 110,000 tons of ore. During each 24-hour cycle in the Pilbara, approximately 11 such trains arrive at Dampier and Port Hedland. Most are composed of more than 300 cars, each bearing about 160 tons of pulverized ore. The dark umber mounds sitting inert in the cars, leveled off in the shape of neat trapezoids, follow each other like a series of mountain ranges. At some point on the Tom Price Road, we crossed a broad, dry watercourse, its floodplain bounded on either side by a gallery forest of gum trees. On our right, at that moment, an ore train is passing. On our left, a group of eight Aboriginal people are standing still in the riverbed, fixated on the train. Dressed in threadbare clothes, carrying cloth bundles holding their possessions, the group has the look of an extended family. For people whose psychological anchor in stressful times is in part the immediacy, the intimate closeness of the physical country they were born to, and whose guiding stories are inextricably woven into that land, the passage of the train is traumatic. Its very presence signifies their loss of ownership and denial of access to their ancestors' land. This is an old story in Australia, in the Americas, on the Tibetan Plateau, and elsewhere. But now, before them in the cars, is the very country itself being shipped off somewhere. For a Christian, a Muslim, or a Jew, it would be as if Jerusalem and the ground it stood on had been put through a rock crusher, and the gravel of the tombs, the temples, the churches, and the prayer walls had been hauled away by NASA to build dormitories on the moon.
That, to me, stood out in so many ways as an act of incredible and brave and important empathy, and brought it home to this reader, at least, in ways that I was completely gut-wrenched. I had to put the book down at the end of that passage. So thank you for that. And I think what I want to ask you is about this idea of imagination. And in the book, you say, it's not possible to say anything definitive here, except perhaps that dramatic change in the near future seems to be in the offing. Mm. And if the species is to achieve its aspiration for justice, reduced suffering, and transcendent life, and if it is to prevent the triumph of machinery that it so clearly fears, an unprecedented level of imagination is required. And in that quote, it is not an unprecedented amount of money. It's not an unprecedented amount of technology. It's not an unprecedented amount of cooperation, even. It is imagination. Why is it imagination that is the most important thing for us to overcome our present moment.
It seems to me that people who are not worried are not paying attention. The signs of big trouble are everywhere. And two things, I think, if we're to go on in some way, have to come into play. First of all, these historically ugly divisions between genders, between races, between ethnic definitions have to be erased. Somebody said to me once, many, many years ago, although we haven't achieved this, we must act as though we have. And in this context, I think of people who are capable of seeing right over the top of racism and all kinds of factionalism, the real grown-ups. One way, in my experience, traditional people define grown-ups as people who no longer need to be supervised, meaning they know immediately how to act in a way that harms no one and takes care of everybody insofar as that is possible. So we're in a time where, when we're desperate for grown-ups, people, another way to define people who've gotten over themselves, to come together and using that power of imagination that each of us has, find a landscape that nobody's ever seen before. Do I think that could happen? Yes. And there is evidence, actually, anthropological or paleoanthropological evidence that at some point, arguably 55 or 60,000 years ago, in what is today Djibouti, in the Horn of Africa, a small group of Homo sapiens, 5,000 people or something like that, there might have been, this might have been triggered by an encephalic event, a change in the morphology of the brain, some little tweak that happened and got passed on and was found to be found to go deep and get rooted in that group of people. And after that, that's when you see civilization. So paleoanthropologists talk about behaviorally modern man as opposed to anatomically modern man. So there, 55,000 years ago, in a relatively short period of time, some form of speciation occurred, and we got China and everything that China stands for. We got Rome, we got Alexander the Great. We got all of this stuff that came in the wake of that change. So is it possible to imagine that a group of grown-ups could come together and push themselves through past, if you will, the horizon of the imagination? Yes, that is possible. But it requires the best in us, and it means you have to ask government to step aside, and you have to ask anyone with a stake in it going one way or another, you have to ask them to step aside. It has to be women and men looking each other in the face and saying, how are we going to get our children into a world of possibility, the one that we have been living in? How are we going to ensure that? And I think that the enormous power of the human imagination comes into play in ways that it's not a technological effort to discover a new tool. It is a spiritual effort
to discover an untapped capacity in human beings to understand what is possible for them under the press of everything that's coming. Democracies turning into dictatorships, global climate change, lack of fresh water. I mean, the whole long list of things that keeps many of us awake at night. If you can't address it directly, you can address it indirectly with an enormous surge in the culture as it exists today to face something and find not victory or these other war terms, but grace. To the discovery of a grace that allows you to manage any horror. And I know in myself, when I've seen things that I would never write about, because it would be cruel to write about them, to bring this into a public arena, but it propels you into the belief that we can do better than this. And if we don't, we don't. But I want to be part of that says, I want to participate in this. I want to do this. And I recognize in my community the women and men who are really capable of managing the complexity of thought here. And I'm going to ask them, what do you want me to do? I'm going to trust that they know, and I am eager to do my part. And I'll tell you a very quick story about one of the ways that I've thought about this. Here in Portland, Mercy Corps is here, of course. And I went and saw Neil Kennigayer once, and I said, I really need to understand more than I do about human plight. I can get caught up in my own world and miss completely what other people are going through. And I said, can you help me design a trip that will introduce me to the human plight? So he did, and I went to Lebanon and visited in Palestinian refugee camps, and then I went to Tajikistan, which was the most economically impoverished of the old Soviet republics, and from there I went to Afghanistan and stayed with some people I'd met at another gathering of people who were talking about what can we do, what can we do. And while I was there, I had my host and I were having dinner one night, and he looked up in the middle of dinner and he said, you know, the worst thing the Taliban did was to destroy those Buddhas at Bamiyan, because that was a statement by Afghan people that we are tolerant. This is not our way of spiritual, this is not our spiritual path, but we respect it and honor it as a spiritual path. And when the Taliban destroyed them, it was like saying, we're all bigots. And then, of course, I remembered the story of the destruction of the Buddhas. And I said to my friend, I can learn as much by seeing those empty grottos where they once stood as I could 2 years ago, and I had gone and seen them as they were. Can you arrange that for me? So he did, and I'm thinking back, what a, it's not a place where you want to be wandering around. So they drove me there, and I saw what was missing, and I saw that the parts of the destruction that were never in the newspapers, the gutting of tolerance that was represented in so many different crude ways in Bamiyan. And when I left there, I went to northern Sumatra, to Banda Aceh, where the tsunami had struck and killed 225,000 people in about 15 minutes. And they were still trying to get back on their feet. And the deference and the courtesy and the imagination and the humor that came into play. I mean, I talked to one man at dinner one night. He had lost 26 members of his family. He was in the fishing boat that morning, at Sunday morning at 8:30, and the tsunami hit there around Banda Aceh.
and his mother, his father, his wife, all of his children, his aunts and uncles, and babies, and everything, everybody died. And he said, you know, we have no way. Banda Aceh is the most conservative part of Indonesia. And he said, you know, we here have no way to, you can't fall in love with somebody and marry them. your parents have to select a person, you know. So when everybody was killed, the men who were out fishing said, well, now what do we do? And so he said it was actually very amusing because it was so awkward. They would say to a friend, would you see the woman over there? If you just go over and ask her if she's married? You know, so they come back and say, no, she's not married. Ah, okay, now what? So he said, we remarried and we had children, and that's what you have to do. So when I got to Jakarta on my way back to the United States, I called Deborah and said, I have more hope for humanity than I had when I landed in Beirut. And I've seen the worst, and I know we'll be all right. And came home. You know.
Wow.
But that my own insistence with myself, go put your face in it and understand what real plight is. You know, people on their hands and knees fighting with the goats in garbage pits in Kabul. There has to be a response that doesn't have anything to do with money. There has to be a response that is entirely about the rediscovery of what it means to love, to place yourself in the other's hands and make between you something, some figurative child that signals survival. Hmm. We can't seem to do that. And all of our watches are ticking. So we must, you know. And the horizon would be the thing that would come to me when I was writing the book. It's all about a horizon. Are you saying to yourself, what is pushing us into the future? Or are you saying, what is calling us into the future? And if it's the latter, you know you'll be okay.
Barry, we've been talking for an hour, which seems impossible to me. So I, again, just want to say that it's a tremendous honor to be launching your book here in Portland and to be on stage with you. Thank you all for coming out tonight. I hope you all buy a copy of Horizon, take it back to your community, read it, and talk about it. It's a beautiful and important book for this particular moment we find ourselves in. So just Barry, thank you so much.
Thank you
for being
you.
Here.
Thank you.
And thank you for coming. Thank you. That was Barry Lopez from a literary arts event in March 2019. This has been Literary Arts, the Archive Project. It's a retrospective of some of the most engaging talks from the world's best writers for more than 35 years of literary arts in Portland. Join us next time for the Archive Project, a literary arts production in collaboration with Oregon Public Broadcasting. To hear more from the Archive Project, subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Support for the Archive Project is provided by Cole Haan, on a mission to fuel your big ideas. More at colehaan.com. Our show is produced by Crystal Liguori for radio and podcast, with production oversight by Amanda Bullock and support from Liz Olofsson. Special thanks to Jyoti Roy and Alana Phelan, and the entire Literary Arts staff, board, and community. This show would not be possible without them. Thanks also to the band Emancipator for our theme music, and thanks to all of you for listening. I'm Andrew Proctor, and this has been another episode of the Archive Project from Literary Arts. Join us next time and find your story here.